Welcome back to hour number three. That was quite a good first 2 hours. 9/11 is today. We're going to talk to a young woman who has not been on this program before. She has done an extraordinary amount of research, however, and I assume she's standing by there. Rebecca, are you there?
I am. Yes, I am.
Where are you? Don't have to tell me the town. What state are you in? What part of the country?
I'm in the western part of the United States.
Good. Right, that narrowed it right down. I like that. All right. Rebecca Roth is our guest, and I've subtitled it 9/11 Whodunit. Rebecca has done some extraordinary work, and I want her just to kind of jump into that, and we'll follow along and chime in here and there and ask her to amplify and further elucidate on things. But what got you pulled into this?
I stopped flying in about 2004. And
you were
a
hostess.
Yes, I was. I was an international purser and a flight attendant for about 30 years at the time of 9/11.
Wow.
I flew until about 2004. And then I never really looked back at the airline or 9/11 or anything else. I saw it unfold on television just like everyone else did.
Yeah.
And in 2008, 2009, somewhere in there, in my retirement, I thought, well, I'll just write that novel everyone I flew with told me I should write. So I started to write a novel just about life in the jet stream and what it was like to do what I did for a living. And I traveled and I saw lots of great places, met lots of neat people all around the world.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well, this would be really kind of fun to base a novel on. And then chapter 2 or 3 into my novel, I decided I'd introduce a Middle Eastern character, and I wanted to grab a name. So I Google searched 19 Arab hijackers from 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, up in front of me came a BBC article written September 23rd, 2001. How did I miss this? 6 of the hijackers were still alive. At least 4 of them were professional airline pilots out of the Middle East. And I was just absolutely shocked.
Aren't there more still alive? I think
there's actually 10.
10, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can see how that knocked you over, sure.
It sure did. And I was so shocked. And then I read a little bit about these, hijackers still alive. I started Googling, started looking, and then I started discovering other things. I set that novel aside and did thousands of hours of research into 9/11 because I have to honestly tell you, even though I never looked back and I couldn't really go there mentally.
Right.
I knew from day one that cell phone calls cannot be made from altitude. And when I started hearing that, and I started hearing that the flight attendants themselves were making cell phone calls, reservations and different family,
yeah.
I knew that was wrong. It's not protocol.
Yeah.
And it can't happen. And then I saw and heard so many things that were wrong that I just put my brain on, don't go there. Look, I'm not going to go there. 'Cause I flew for a few years after that. And listen, when you're flying, your safety net is NORAD and the U.S. military. And I've had jets scrambled for me before for different incidences over my career.
Huh.
And they come to your wingtips, and it's very frightening because sometimes you can see their armament hanging from them. And they'll maybe shoot you down. You just don't know. But the feeling is horrible, except they do scramble and come to your rescue in 6 minutes. On that day, it took almost 2 hours. And after
whoops,
9/11,
something wrong there.
Yeah. I was like, well, my first question was, when somebody called me and said, turn your television on right now. And I'd just gotten home from Europe and I'd come in as a purser. So I hadn't seen any FAA warnings about hijackers or anything or Al Qaeda. And we'd never been told about Osama bin Laden.
Osman, yes.
Or I later on found out he was a CIA asset in the mid 80s. To start up the Mujahideen for the CIA. And so I didn't know about him or Osama bin Laden or Al-Qaeda. They had never told us or warned us that this could be possible, a hijacking group.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so shocked. I saw that second plane go into the South Tower like a hot knife through butter. And honestly, I thought it was either trick photography or a new rendition of War on the War of the Worlds.
Wow.
I thought it was somebody was joking because planes cannot disappear into a steel building. They're made of aluminum. And if you've ever seen an aircraft that's been in a real major hailstorm or hit by a large bird, they do a lot of damage. Those planes are very fragile. I've seen them take a bird strike and a lightning strike and see what happens. So I really thought it was some kind of trick photography, and I had jet lag and I didn't know what was going on. And the person on the other end of the phone was saying, "It's terrorists." And I'm like, well, you know, later on that day, I said, well, how did they get control of NORAD? How did they control our military? That was my main question, is so how could somebody on a, you know, the laptop and a satellite phone stop NORAD from scrambling?
And how many hours?
Well, they were an hour and 45 minutes, I believe.
My goodness.
Close to New York.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's really interesting what happened.
Well, then we get the story about, who was it, Leon Panetta? I can't remember now. About Dick Cheney being told.
Yeah, that was Norman Mineta.
Norman Mineta, not Leon Panetta.
See, with this... kind of like they could be a part of the same song. Mm-hmm. He was actually in the bunker with Vice President Dick Cheney. Because a young soldier would come in and say to the vice president, the aircraft is 20 miles out, sir.
He'd give him mileage checks. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he said, the airplane is 5 miles out, sir. Do your orders still stand? And Norman Mineta, you know, he's on record saying this. I believe he said it at the 9/11 commission hearings, I think. And, or before that, I don't know. He's certainly on record just saying that. It's very well known. And Dick Cheney said, have my orders still stand? Have I changed? No, my orders still stand, as if he knew what was about to happen. And shortly thereafter, just a moment, something hit the Pentagon. And so what I found in looking for my second book, because I've just released the second book, Methodical Deception, is I followed up with people like Norman Mineta. And
very good.
From the FAA.
Yeah.
And I know I'm going to send you these books as soon as I want to send you hardbacks. And I think
they'll come in on
Wednesday for the new book.
I appreciate that. The first book is Methodical Illusion.
Uh-huh.
And the second book is...
Methodical Deception.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect.
Yeah. And so what I did was I followed up with people that I think should have lost their jobs that day and found where they went and where they're sitting, what board of directors they're sitting on.
They got rewarded. They got, the big prize. Yeah.
Yeah. Really big prize. And you know, it's interesting talking about Norman Mineta. You know, if you listen to the official story of 9/11,
you're right. A rapper would love those two guys in a song.
They would. And if you listen to the official story, they claim there was a gun on board. Mm-hmm. There was bombs on some of the aircraft, knives and box cutters, and pepper spray and mace. Mm-hmm. Those were all illegal to bring on board an aircraft at the time of 9/11. And so you have to look at who was running security. And these are the things that I looked at in every single detail on 9/11.
Well, unfortunately, we know now who was. So tell us who was running the security.
Yeah, this is very interesting. There was a company started out of Israel called ICTS International, and they had a subsidiary in the United States called Huntley USA. And I remember seeing ICTS and Huntley USA almost everywhere I went. Because that was before.
That's really. So they penetrated the entire aeronautical business industry and got into practically every airport.
Exactly. But what's really weird is the company ICTS was started by an Israeli convict who had been convicted of making fraudulent documents, campaign finance problems, and two or three other things. He'd actually was in prison. And so he gave the company control to somebody else in Israel. And they brought that company to the United States as Huntley USA. And for some reason, United and American both signed up with them. They controlled almost all of their services. security, and almost every other airport in the United States did. But what's really weird, Huntley or ICTS International runs security all over the EU. They ran security when Richard Reid, the tennis shoe bomber, came through Charles de Gaulle.
Yeah.
They ran security also through Amsterdam Schiphol Airport when the panty bomber that almost took Northwest Airlines down going into Detroit on a Christmas morning.
Mm-hmm.
Same, they ran that security. They ran security at Boston Logan, Dulles International, Washington, D.C., and Newark on 9/11. So you think, okay, now how did they get bombs and knives and all of that stuff?
Yeah.
Through? So at three airports, now we know of five, actually, where supposed terrorists with bombs had allowed through Huntley. Guess who's sitting on their board of directors right now? Secretary of Transportation, Norman Mineta.
Oh, no.
Now, think about this. In reality, they failed to stop the shoe bomber, the underwear bomber, and everything that happened on 9/11. But one thing I did discover is there were not 19 Arabs on the real passenger manifest. That's a story that's generated just by the FBI as part of the cover-up of what really did take place.
Mm-hmm. Wow, Rebecca. Wow. What a journey you've been on. What you have seen. You know too much. It's in your books. I'm very happy about that. I hope that they do very well. It's time that we get the truth of this out. The words, the terms, inside job, really don't even come close to the dynamics involved in this tragedy. It was huge.
Mm-hmm.
We were sold out by our own. Will you tell us?
Well, that's true. And what happened to me was I immediately, once I started to see the hijackers were alive, I found an FBI document. It was a transcript of the two flight attendants from Flight 11. They were the first two people to call and to contact anyone that they were being hijacked or something was wrong.
Uh-huh.
So I was very fortunate because I just put my flight attendant shoes back on and said, okay, I'm going in there with them. And I listened to every word. And Betty Ong called reservations, which is a line no flight attendant would call because you're on hold, just like you guys are, just like passengers, 10, 15 minutes on hold.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're calling in a real emergency like a hijacking, you can't be on the phone for a long period of time because if a real hijacker saw you on the phone, they'd probably
kill you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was not part of the protocol, was to make phone calls outside. But we had two flight attendants that did that. One used a cell phone and one used an onboard phone. And Betty Ong called reservations and she said one hijacker as a he has sprayed pepper spray or mace in business class and we can't breathe in business class. And I read that again and I thought, wait a minute. Now, what went through my 30 years career in my mind?
Uh-huh.
Leaving Honolulu with that cheap perfume, that flowery stuff they spray in, and the whole airplane would fill up with it. Somebody sprayed it, you know, everybody smelled like puka flowers or something. Or dropping a duty-free rum somewhere in the airplane, everyone would smell it. And I thought to myself, wait a minute, if this airplane were pressurized at altitude and someone sprayed something as bad as pepper spray or mace, both of which are not legal.
Okay, go through the whole plane.
Including the hijackers, would be suffering from it. And yet both of those flight attendants were on the phone for 27 minutes. Neither of them ever coughed, choked, gagged, or said, my eyes are killing me. I can't breathe. I'm having trouble. They didn't. You see what they said? There was gas only up in one section. And they talked on the phone for nearly a half an hour. And so she said something else. She said he stood upstairs. And that, to somebody else, that means nothing, but I know there are only stairs on a 747. She was on a 767.
No stairs.
I knew, since they were not pressurized and she was calling, they were on the ground somewhere in a hangar, and there are stairs in every corner of a hangar. And so what I did was I thought, well, then 20 minutes from Boston, let me find where they could be. And I knew that those aircraft, because they were heavy, they were full of fuel to go from coast to coast. Even though the loads were light, they're still landing what we call heavy in the industry. They needed at least a 10,000-foot runway, and lo and behold, if I didn't find a reserve Air Force base, within 18 minutes of Boston, four aircraft were taken over remotely using the flight termination system, which was sold to the airlines.
Mm-hmm.
Sue Boeing, first from a company called SPC Corporation.
Another Israeli company.
Interestingly enough, not only that, the CEO of that company was Rabbi Dov Zakheim, who was also the comptroller of the Pentagon.
Dov Zakheim, who on September the 10th announced that there was, what was it, $2 trillion missing from the Pentagon budget?
Yep, he was the banker. He was the comptroller there. He was also the CEO of SPC Corporation.
Unbelievable.
They also have a subsidiary company at SPC called TriData. And after the 1993 bombing that the FBI did of the World Trade Center, TriData got most of the reconstruction and got the blueprints for the towers.
Oh, my.
So here they come in the early 90s and they sell these to Boeing. Boeing comes to the commercial carriers in the United States and they sell it by this. In the event of a hijacking and a hijacker could take over the cockpit, we can land the aircraft remotely where it will be liberated by a hostage rescue team. And I said, well, who's we? Who's we can take control remotely? Who are those we? I found who they are in my 9/11 investigation.
Oh, so congratulations. Wow. You solved whodunit.
Yeah. That's really it. The methodical illusion. And since I was in cognitive dissonance, I was afraid to look into this. And really, what slapped me across the face was finding the hijackers were still alive. And that the FBI was being sued by the Saudi government for stealing the identity. And I thought to myself, how difficult would it be for a professional airline person to travel around having that to live with, that you're one of the 9/11 hijackers? I mean, that was worldwide information. And they're still, to this day, in Wikipedia as the guilty parties, and they're still flying.
Didn't one of them sue?
I know the Saudi government was threatening to sue the FBI. I could never find a lawsuit. I'm assuming
maybe they didn't then. I don't know.
Somebody must have gotten some sort of payoff. I can't find any documentation that a lawsuit was settled.
Well, we know that the Israelis were involved in this up to their eyeballs and further. Who do you think was the ultimate mastermind? Was this an Israeli op?
It appears to be pretty much a Mossad operation.
That would have been my guess. Yeah.
And so when I was going through and dissecting these phone calls from the two flight attendants, I noticed that Amy Sweeney, the other flight attendant that called in, she made a mistake no flight attendant would ever make. And you can rest assured.
She did it on purpose.
She did. Yeah. And when I finished reading these two girls' transcripts from an FBI document, I said to my husband, they just needed a flight attendant to read this because I can hear everything they're saying. And I could.
Oh, my.
The hijacker, again, one he, was in 9B. And later on, she called back and she said, oh, I made a mistake. The hijacker's in 10B. It was 9B was stabbed. But I looked to see who 9B was because no flight attendant would make that mistake because she didn't have any guarantee she could make a second phone call.
Got it.
You never make that statement unless you were 150% sure, because in a hijacking, we get that plane on the ground. Come hell or high water, we're going to bring it to the ground, and there it will be liberated by a hostage rescue team. So I looked in to see who 9B was, and lo and behold, he was part of the Israeli Defense Forces Special Operations Unit called Sayeret Metkal. They are highly trained assassins. He was an
Was in that Levin? Or what was his name?
Daniel Lewin.
Lewin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what I found was he was a highly trained assassin. He was an anti-hijacking specialist.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah. He was also a hostage rescue team. These were the people when there was a hijacking out of Israel.
Yes.
And going into anywhere.
Yes.
And anywhere, they would be sent in. And they would liberate the plane, just like I told you earlier with the flight termination system, how it was sold to us. So that means this guy in 9B, who was, by the way, he grew up in Denver. He was fluent in English, Arabic, and Hebrew. So the guys, if they were really sitting behind him planning the new Pearl Harbor event of this hijacking, he would have been able to hear them perfectly. and understand exactly what they were planning and do something. Because, you know, as I continued to read about him, his friends from the Israeli Defense Forces, mm-hmm. they said about him he could kill any human being with a pen and a credit card. Well, he was traveling on business because he was the CEO of a company called Akamai Technologies, also located in Massachusetts. And so I thought, well, gee, now that's really interesting, because the hostage rescue person knows exactly how everything on a Boeing works. The PA system.
Sure.
We can call the pilots. We can make a PA announcement that'll go off in the cockpit and the cabin or in different parts of the aircraft. He would know how the doors work. He would know where cockpit keys are kept. He would know how strong a cockpit door was if he needed to kick it in, all of those things, because he's a hostage rescue specialist. And an anti...
Too bad he wasn't on board MH370.
He may have been. Ooh, this sure. We don't... Because we don't know what happened to that plane,
no,
do we?
We don't.
It's a similar story than what happened to this one. Because, you see, when the flight termination system takes over an aircraft remotely, which they did on all four aircraft, it operates on the same frequency as the airplane's transponder. Okay. The transponder tells the air traffic controller your altitude, the airline you are, the type of aircraft you are, your speed, and things like that. So the minute the flight termination system takes over, boom, you disappear from radar. And they did. So they could have landed them anywhere. And they did. They landed
Land in Cleveland, one of them?
No, they all went to one Air Force base in
the
Western.
The Air Force base.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so all four planes went into a hangar, so they weren't visible.
They had hangars that facilitate C-5 transport planes, which are bigger than 747.
They can all go in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They have six of them, though, so they could each have their own.
All these people that were then executed somehow?
I believe they were, and now after Methodical Illusion came out, hordes of pilots and flight attendants have come on and said, you have figured this out. This is exactly what happened. And what we think collectively, and we can only guess, is that the handlers on board, because there were not hijackers, but there were handlers, much like 9B on Flight 11.
Sure.
More than likely, they had guns. And that we think they probably told the crew that they were part of one of those ongoing war games going on and testing the NORAD response system.
Sure.
And once they got them on the ground, the first three aircraft, two people were removed. Flight 11, two flight attendants were removed, and they were taken upstairs, just like Betty Ong said. He stood upstairs. That's where they were, in a hangar. And upstairs on the hangars are office space. And that's why Betty Ong and Amy Sweeney were telling two different stories. They were telling totally opposite details of what was supposedly going on board, because they didn't know what was really supposed to be going on. They didn't know the story. They hadn't been briefed well enough, and they were, you know, nervous and not knowing what the other one was saying. And again, that was a red flag for me, because when you're in a hijacking, the most important thing is all communication is what it is. It's not different. It has to be the same. So if you're giving your location, like you're sitting at your jump seat at 3R, if the hostage rescue people want to come through the back door, they'd want you to move, or you're going to have broken knees.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is sad. Some people talked about the planes having been flown out over the Atlantic and crashed into the ocean. But
because you
happened.
See, on a plane crash into the ocean, you just saw this with
debris everywhere.
Always, always. And remember, your seat bottom cushion is a flotation device.
Sure.
Always. Remember Air Asia that crashed, the Airbus, and the big tail section they pulled up. And then the first thing that popped up were people that were strapped in their seats that came floating to the surface. And that will always happen. So that's just nonsense. That's somebody who doesn't know what happens when you crash an airplane into the ocean. But there was a lot of conspiracy, crazy theories. And listen, when I read them, I was like, oh, my goodness. No wonder airline people stayed away from this, because there was so much disinformation, like all the planes flying to Cleveland. And then, listen, you cannot take people that paid good money to go from New York or Boston to L.A. and then take them to Cleveland. And you think you're going to take them in a commercial airport and get them on another airplane to go somewhere else? No. It will mutiny on you. I have seen it happen from Storm.
These are simple answers to questions that no one has ever really asked before. They just come up with the answer, and that's it. Who puts the answer out there? I couldn't tell you, but I could guess.
Well, it's really interesting. What I did was I started following some of the people for the second book, Methodical Deception, mm-hmm. that made phone calls. And it's amazing what I discovered. And then if we have time, are we going to take...
Oh, no. I'm going to go through this break. Go ahead.
If we have time, let me just tell you about this. A lot of people ask me about this woman who was on supposedly Flight 77, Barbara Olson.
You sure?
She has a really interesting background. Her dad was Jewish. I can't find any information about her mom, so I just know that her dad was. And he was kind of a slumlord in Texas. And she went to a couple years of college down in Texas where she grew up.
Uh-huh.
Then she went to Hollywood for a decade, you know, liberal Hollywood. She came out as a conservative a pundit, I guess you'd call her. And so she spends a decade in Hollywood and you can't find any information with her. She was acting. She could have been doing commercials, taking acting lessons. We don't know. She worked for HBO and Stacey Keach Productions. Other than that, she could have been anything from an actress to a copy girl. There's just nothing out there about her. But she spent 10 years in Hollywood, liberal Hollywood. And then she went to a Jewish law school called Yeshiva Law School. And it's, I think the name of their law part is Ben Cordova Law School. She goes to law school and she graduates and goes right to the top of the pig pile in Washington, D.C.
Amazing how they fast track their own.
It's amazing. She goes into a law firm called Wilmer, Cutler and Pickering. Now, Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering, they have a really interesting background. Cutler was the White House counsel for Carter and Bill Clinton.
I remember him.
And another partner was C. Boyden Gray. C. Boyden Gray was the White House counsel for George H.W. Bush when he was vice president and president. There's another interesting partner at this law firm with Barbara Olson, Jamie Gorelick, who sat on the 9/11 commission. There was somebody else who's really interesting, and I found that part of the cover-up was through the FBI. But the former FBI director, Robert Mueller, was also a partner in the same law firm as Barbara Olson.
Oh, now, my. This is wild. How do you sleep at night with all this data? You've got it all.
I'm constantly doing researching, and it's much deeper than this. We could go on for 3 hours, I kid you not. So
I believe you.
Who's interesting, that was in that same law firm, William Weld. He was the governor at Massachusetts, and he also was the coach for George W. Bush for the debates against John Kerry. He was his coach.
Huh.
I thought, oh, this is really interesting. Barbara Olson, she was right in there with some very interesting connected people to the CIA and the FBI. And so then I go to their client list, and lo and behold, fasten your seatbelt, Jeff Rentz, you are never going to believe, in alphabetical order, who's at the top of the list? 9B, remember I told you the name?
Yes.
Akamai Technologies is a client of Barbara Olson's law firm that she went to work.
All in the family. Unbelievable.
But it gets better going down the alphabetical list. Amdocs. Amdocs was...
I know about Amdocs.
And they monitored every phone call in the United States because they were part of billing systems.
They do the billing, folks, for your cell phone, for your most probably your landline, but almost virtually all cell phones, all mobile phones, portable phones, smart devices, Amdocs. Well, apparently, there is no company in the United States competent enough to do it, so they have to contract it out to an Israeli company.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
There's another company called Analog Devices, and they work with missile technology and drones. And another one, AT&T, you know, that's a communication company. But here's the one that really got me, stopped me right in my tracks.
Yeah.
Avid Technologies. They're a company that specializes in video and audio production technology, and they specialize in something that's called digital nonlinear editing. It's NLE. Now, this is something that's like a cut and paste of live video editing. And a great example of that is since it's NFL season starting up. Now, in the last few years, you remember you've seen this, the line of scrimmage shows up as a bright orange line. But if you're in the stadium, you can't see that. That's done through this live editing. And they also put in the teams and the arrows that the Dallas Cowboys are going this way. And you don't see that. And the advertisements that they put around the stadium, you don't see those if you're in the stadium. They don't exist. They're put in through using the Avid Technologies non-linear editing system. So I wonder if maybe something like a Tomahawk cruise missile were going toward the South Tower, if this same technology could be used to make it look like a 767. I'm just wondering. I'm not sure, but I'm just wondering, and I find it interesting. Another interesting...
There were supposedly no windows visible on some of those aircraft.
That's correct. And the firefighters from the fireboat, I've listened to their calling into dispatch, and they said it was a military aircraft, like a bomber style with no windows, dark green or gray or something. Well, this same law firm also represents Boeing, Citicorp, the Credit Suisse Bank, Deutsche Bank, the HSBC, which everyone knows is just CIA money laundering, and the UBS Bank. And if you've looked into any of the terrorist financing with Scott Bennett and those things, the UBS Bank is right in there. Mm-hmm. And they also were sitting in a special investigative committee hired by the board of directors for Enron and WorldCom.
Good God.
You'll remember Enron, the evidence for their trial, which was going to trial the next month in October of 2000.
Oh, man.
In Building 7, the Solomon Building that fell down without being an aircraft at 5:20 that afternoon. All of the evidence.
Lost.
Forever.
Doggone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is really something. I talked about All in the Family. I mean, the interconnectivity of this is just enough to want to make you puke. These people are thicker than thieves. Thicker than thieves.
It is. This isn't even the tip of the iceberg.
Come on, Rebecca. This is unbelievable.
I spent 4 hours today with John B. Wells. I think he sliced three of it into a video or a show. And honest to goodness, he had to get up and take a break. He was sick to his stomach. He felt like, I mean, we went into this so in depth that this is nothing. But this is just an example of what I did with everyone that I saw was in a position to make a phone call or stop the event. And I followed everyone. Now, after Methodical Illusion came out, and I never... You know, mentioned the name of the Air Force base. I just said it was a reserve base. I had a reserve person contact me and tell me that she was based there and that they were activated after the second plane hit. And then when they got there, the base had been evacuated and that the entire unit, it was around 2,000 of them, were locked out for 2 to 3 days. They were put up in hotels. And she said, until I heard your interview, I had no idea those planes were in our hangars.
Wonder what they did to the people.
Well, you know how they love to give you a little hint.
They probably gassed them.
Yep. They used something much more lethal than mace or pepper spray.
Oh, yeah.
And it was quick. And we think that the crew were probably told they were part of a drill. So when they removed those two people to make the phone calls on the first jets, they tossed in a canister of something. Now, we train with those things. We train with smoke bombs like that for simulating a smoke-filled cabin in our yearly training. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't be until a flight attendant or someone realized that was cyanide gas or something that they couldn't move. They didn't have the strength to open the door. And if they did, they just fell out. That's kind of what we think. I mean, that's.
Well, they're not nerve gases, which dissipate fairly quickly, I'm told. They would have had to certainly evacuate that hangar of living people and then take the bodies out. Easily, they could have tractor trailer and gotten rid of all of them. How many bodies were there altogether?
About 260. And one of the things that people ask me is, how come the loads were so light? Because each aircraft held around 200, give or take 20. And the reason is because that there was a group of Israeli spies in this country.
Sure.
Parading around as art students.
Oh, yeah, the art students,
were also connected to a company called NICE, N-I-C-E, all capital letters. Mm-hmm. They are a company that was started from 7 veterans from the Signal Intelligence Unit of the Israeli Mossad. Uh-huh. And they started NICE, and it's a surveillance company. They actually are surveilling all of Glasgow, Scotland right now under camera and audio. And so they were a specialist in tapping phone and computer systems. So Now, there's lots of evidence that the phone lines were tapped for United and American. And so I'm assuming they also took their, made it so that there were very, very light loads, so they only had 260 people to get rid of.
Unreal. Just amazing what you've done. Amazing. Stand by. We do have to take this break. We'll come right back in another segment to go with Rebecca Roth. This is stunning. You've figured it out. You've done it. This is stunning. Back in a minute. Okay, so in all likelihood, they just put the passengers in their planes, gassed them, removed the corpses after they evacuated the nerve gas from the plane, and trucked them out of there, got rid of them.
Yeah, well, most of the large bases like that, and that is the second largest base in area in the United States, most of them have large incinerators. So it's hard.
They burned them up.
They probably did. I'm going to guess. I mean, they had that base. Those people were locked out for 3 days.
Plenty of time to cremate them all. Not cremate, burn them all. These are probably very high temperature furnaces they use, not like crematories, which are about 600 degrees. These are probably much more like 1,000, 1,500. Mm-hmm. And I'm just guessing, but they would probably have the state-of-the-art available to them. This is amazing.
Yeah. What another thing that I found, you know, when I first looked at this, I read all the stories and I kind of fell into that whole emotional thing. And on flight 175, there were two people that called, and there were two men passengers. One was a pilot that had flown in the Gulf War, and it's such a small world, Jeff, that his pilot's wife contacted me on email and said, Brian Sweeney was not a pilot. I said, well, that's what the FBI document says. I sent it to her in email. And she said he was a radar intercepting officer.
Uh-huh. Intercept officer, sure. Yeah.
He writes in the backseat. I said, oh, really? Well, that's interesting that the FBI called him a pilot, and so did his mom. So I just kind of put that around. For some reason, I decided to look into him. And I actually went on his online obituaries, and everybody can find this stuff. I haven't found this. I'm not privy to any magic information. Everything I found is just through looking for it. And I found his obituary, and like reading and reading, having a cup of coffee, and keep reading down, and all of a sudden, someone says to him, I remember you, Brian, from the M cafeteria when we both worked at MITRE. Now, MITRE and PTEC were two companies that Indira Singh told us about were working in the FAA headquarters for 2 years prior to 9/11.
God, this is all Mossad.
Uh-huh. Yep. And so here he is. He's sitting at row 31, left-hand side of the aircraft, and I have gotten a terabyte of Freedom of Information Act data where they claim where those planes were. And now it's impossible that he was anywhere near where they claim the plane was, 7,000-foot elevation over the Hudson River, looking off the left side of the aircraft, a beautiful view 7,000 feet above.
Yeah, yeah.
Newark International Airport, and he tells his mother at that moment that they're over Ohio. And I'm thinking, well, how could you be over the Hudson? Now, if you look out the right side, you're seeing Manhattan skyline and the Statue of Liberty. The other guy that called also was from row 31, but he was on the right side. Instead of seeing the Statue of Liberty at 7,000-foot elevation, he told his father that for some reason, he thought that the hijackers were going to take their plane to Chicago and fly it into a building.
The Sears Tower.
Yeah, and so, you know, there was a plane that didn't, for some reason, get hijacked remotely. Something went wrong. But I've actually, in the Freedom Information Act data that I have, I found an accident report for Delta Flight 1989. Uh-huh. It did go to Cleveland. It's the only plane that went into Cleveland. And it went there because the FAA told them they had a hijacker on board and a bomb. And the pilot said, no, the flight attendants are serving breakfast. There's nothing wrong here. And they said, you have to land in Cleveland. Well, I think the handlers, something went wrong connecting that plane to the remote.
To the remote. And the handlers, they couldn't take it. I see.
Get handlers off.
What happened to the Delta flight eventually, ultimately?
Well, by the time it landed, it was a little after 10 in the morning.
Uh-huh.
You'll remember that the ground stop had taken place. So all the airplanes were forced to land.
Yes.
And nobody could take off. So what happened is everything got grounded at that point. So it landed and it sat in a remote parking place because the feds kept saying there was a bomb on board. And it sat there for 3 or 4 hours. I have that documentation somewhere.
Oh, Rebecca, I'm just stunned.
Yeah. And then when people have, they spun a conspiracy about all these planes going to Cleveland. No, just one did. And if they did use the NASA hangar, there is a big NASA hangar real close to the airport in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If they did, it was only because the airport was full of planes. Everybody had to land at the
nearest. Well, it was grounded. Everything was grounded, of course. Grounded.
And so the terminal was full. And so if they took them over there, it was only because they needed a place where cabs could come and take them to hotels.
Sure.
Or could maybe rent cars or, you know, get out of there, figure out what to do. Because at that time, you'll remember, nobody knew what was going on. I mean,
Friends, our wonderful ally, that marvelous little democracy in the Middle East, Israel, and its Bolshevik Zionist City of London Rothschild owners, handlers, came over here, set this up at the behest of I don't know whom, slaughtered over 250 Americans, or thereabout, set this whole thing up, and look what they accomplished from it. This is all part of Greater Israel. They destroyed Iraq. They destroyed Libya. They've beaten the hell out of Afghanistan, which will always be Afghanistan. Now they're trying to do the same thing to Syria. This is all about Israel taking charge on behalf of the Rothschild banksters. In London, the city of London, that little 2-square-mile area that answers to no one. This is about a private storefront business called Israel. This is the Rothschilds' private storefront business. This is how they run operations all around the world. God, I'm sick.
You don't even know a 16th of what I've uncovered. And in the second book, Methodical Deception, and so your readers know, if you like autographed books, I have 3 websites where you can find these books and order them autographed, and I'll send them out to you. Illusion.com, methodicaldeception.com, and RebeccaRoth.com. And it's Rebecca spelled the biblical way with a K.
Nice. Yeah, I noticed my webmaster fixed that.
Yeah, and so I love doing autograph books. It connects me with the readers, and they share.
Oh, it's a very, very special thing to do. I'm glad.
Awesome. Well, here's something that happened to me after I did a radio show.
Uh-huh.
A woman contacted me.
Yeah.
And she said, "You have vindicated me. And for 14 years, people were saying I was crazy."
Uh-huh.
And I said, "Well, really, why?" Well, here's her story. This is now in a notarized affidavit in my safe, and mm-hmm. this is her story, but this is not her name,
mm-hmm.
but it's in the novel Methodical Deception.
Mm-hmm.
She said, "My name is Sarah Swain, and I was living in Otis, Massachusetts on September 11th, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
At approximately 8:30, 8:35, I saw a United Airlines plane fly over my residence at the time, and I was so shocked because the plane was so low. I could see the people in the windows. I was standing on a deck on the second floor, and I was watching the plane fly over the top of the house, and I lost track of it because of the way the building was, but I do think that it was going north when it flew over the house and after I lost sight of it. I was speaking with my neighbor, and we were just amazed at the height of the plane. It was so low. I shouldn't say height. I mean altitude. It was so low, we were flabbergasted. Now I know that it was approximately 8:30, I would say no later than 8:45 at the latest. because I had to go to an appointment in the next town over and be there by 9:30.
Uh-huh.
And I left 5 minutes after I saw the plane and headed to Great Barrington. Now, this town, Otis, Massachusetts, is not the Air Force Base. This is due west of Westover Air Force Base in western Massachusetts. I had tracked Flight United 175 mm-hmm. on their flight plan mm-hmm. to just south of Westover, and I knew that they had to fly directly over Otis. And when she called
wow.
me, it's all confirmed. This is not a conspiracy. Every pilot and flight attendant that's read these books and
yeah.
my interviews has said, this is it. Now I have a woman who's willing to go to court. The affidavit signed and notarized.
You be careful, young lady. Very careful. I mean, it's thank God you've gotten this out. It's out. You're safe. If you can get the information out, that gives you a measure of safety.
And yeah, I was very cautious with the first book.
Yeah.
Nobody knew about it. I even had to self-edit it. I couldn't trust anybody.
Oh, good for you. You did it right. You did it right. All that extra work was worth it.
Well, you know, you see people like Andrew Breitbart and Michael Hastings.
Oh, they kill them. Right? They kill people all the time. They tried to kill me April 24th. They shut my brain off at 65 miles an hour. It, just an energy weapon. And the car went off the highway into a ditch, flipped, rolled, spun, did the whole thing. And I had brain injuries and broken wrist and hand. And I was very lucky. I survived it. And the firefighters said that was a non-survivable wreck. You should not have survived that.
Yeah.
And so anyway, they do. Andrew Breitbart and Michael, they killed them.
Yeah, I have found the weapons. I found patents. I mean, I'm digging into this still. I've got another book or two. It's science fiction. People can't even comprehend what was used on.
Well, I hope to God you don't end up putting me in one of your books. But these murders need to be covered.
They do.
These are very important people playing a very serious role in a deadly business, the truth. And
mm-hmm.
they paid the ultimate price. And how long have the remote control devices been standard equipment on most Boeing airliners?
These flight termination system things were sold in the early 90s to us. But, you know, technology was available since the 70s.
Okay, folks, I want you to please remember that, too. That's very important. Rebecca, would you come back? I don't know if... Do I have your phone number?
I think you do.
Don't give it to me on the air.
Connect it on Skype, but I can text it to your guy.
Yeah, text it to the network, and I want to call you and arrange for another visit.
Okay, sounds great. And I'll get those books off to you real quick.
You're talking to probably the most intelligent audience in talk radio. These are wonderfully informed people. And you have just brought an awful lot of friends into your circle.
Oh, thank you.
You made a lot of friends. Thank you.
It's truth comes out. We need to wake people up to who's the real enemy.
Well, we'll have you back and we'll talk about the new book, Methodical Deception. And I think I can do that in another week and a half. But you take care of yourself, and thank you more than I can thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Rebecca. Good night.
Good night.
Wow. There it is. There it is. Right there in front of you. That's what happened. Our friend, Israel. No wonder they hate me. They got another big smear piece out of me. Sticks and stones. Words can never hurt me. How's it go? You remember. But there are worse things than sticks and stones they can use. It's unfortunate. All right. That's a remarkable, remarkable interview, both of them. We'll have Rebecca back as soon as I can arrange it. Thank you for being here. It is a weekend. I hope you have a good weekend. Take care of yourselves, and we will talk very soon.